Hello, and welcome to part two of CKUT's long-term memory radio series on gender and school.
In the first segment of this series, we heard the stories of queer and transgendered students as they explained their first-hand encounters with gender discrimination throughout their school careers.
Today we are looking at empowerment. We know sexism, homophobia, and transphobia exist in schools, but what are we going to do about them? But he's got a
real one, and mine's first, we will hear from feminist activist and scholar Charlotte Bunch. Charlotte Bunch is a professor at Rutgers University in New Jersey and is the author of many books, including Learning Our Way, Essays in Feminist Education. And a girl, they're so glued down in this world and what it means. I'm trans, all of that. I'm trans, all of that. Gender, I'm a bender.
I'm on the phone with Charlotte Bunch, who is an author and a feminist organizer. Maybe we could start off by you explaining some of your recent work, and maybe a bit more specifically too around the Center for Women's Global Leadership.
Okay. Well, I'm the director of the Center for Women's Global Leadership, and our work is to advance the idea that women should be taking leadership roles in society, including at the global level. And we work in particular on women's leadership internationally in the field of women's human rights and the voices of women on issues of human rights in the UN and other settings. We also work on campus, we're based at Rutgers University, with young women on how they can become a part of thinking about global issues and having some leadership within the United States on how global issues are shaped and how we might change those things.
How exactly can this be done when we're talking about empowering women through education? How do you seek to go about that?
Well, my view is that we work to make options open to women that they might not know about. And for me, that's really what education is about. Education should always be an empowering experience. It isn't always, because sometimes it's used more to indoctrinate people than to empower them. But what we try to do is to use the educational process to make women and also men aware of what's available to them in society and what the issues are and what they might do, and to see it as empowerment in the sense that knowledge is power, having some awareness of the world, having some sense of what's out there and how you might impact it, is a piece of the empowering process. And giving women on campus, young women, mostly undergraduate students at Rutgers, some of them graduate students, an opportunity to meet women leaders from around the world, to learn from them, giving them opportunity to have internships with projects in other parts of the world so that they begin to see what it means to think about these issues is sort of our approach to empowerment with the students.
Are there basic gender disparities that you see at work right now within the North American education system?
Yes, I think we still have strong gender disparities. They're not as strong as they were when I was growing up, but I think there's still a tendency in our school system for boys to be encouraged to lead and to take the leading role in activities, or to be the future presidents, or to be the presidents of the classes, or to be the active ones. And girls in particular, maybe not so much in the first few years. I think in elementary school it's less so, but girls in particular, when they become teenagers and sometimes in the college setting, they're still not so much encouragement to lead in the public sphere. I think they are encouraged to make good grades and to study, but not to see themselves as having a voice in the public world. And so for me, that's really a gender disparity that affects who imagines themselves later being involved politically, whether that's in elected politics or community politics, or just seeing yourself as a writer or as a person who could comment on things, I think we still do have that gender disparity in the North American context. It's not as bad as it used to be. It's better and worse in different places, but I think it's still there.
Why do you feel that those still exist, though? Are there specific interests at work that seek to that use the strategy of empowering men a lot more than women?
Well, I think it's still a deep-seated cultural bias. I think we've done a lot of work in the last 40 and 50 years to start to change that, but I think I, as a young feminist, underestimated the strength of that cultural bias. I think, of course, that it serves the interests of men to maintain some domination in a fairly narrow sense, not in a broad sense. But I don't even think it's that necessarily that thought through. I think it's still just very deep within our culture in North America, as well as other parts of the world, that somehow men have more authority, and it's still needs breaking down. And it particularly, you see it when you get into political spheres where it's been harder to imagine women having the power to make certain kinds of important decisions. That's still an area certainly some women have broken through, and I think more will, but it's still an area where culturally people are sometimes uncomfortable when you see women talking about sort of major decisions about where military should be and how money should be spent and those kinds of areas. Hopefully it will break down more. But, yes, of course, in a sense it serves some interest, but I don't even have a conspiracy theory. I think some of it is just how long it takes to change those attitudes.
I read a quote of yours from the Feminism and Education book, actually, in a Bell Hooks book, where you were talking about basic literacy as being very important to educating women. Maybe you could elaborate a bit on the issue of basic mm-hmm. literacy.
Well, I think there's a couple of layers of the issue of literacy. Basic literacy, of course, is still a very important issue for women internationally. There's still a big gender disparity in the world in terms of who gets access to the fundamentals of reading and writing. So that's still an issue in the world today. But I also mean by basic literacy a sort of literacy about the world, economic literacy in which you learn about budgeting and about the way money gets spent and who decides what and why, so that you really have women feeling that they can participate in the economic life of their communities and not feel intimidated about those decisions. You have literacy in public speaking and having your voice heard, that I think is very important. And the literacy of just being a citizen, in a way. Women need to be able to see themselves as the ones that have responsibility as well as opportunity for asserting their citizenship. So there's kind of a number of levels depending on what you already have. But in some parts of the world, just that very first one of having access to the written word is still an important one.
One interesting thing that we've seen in the last 30-odd years is, across university campuses in North America is more of an emphasis put on women's education, feminist studies, and also the emergence of women's studies programs and centers for women's learning at a lot of these campuses. Maybe you could speak to what exactly we mean when we say feminist education, and how does that apply to education from a very young age to a university student age?
Well, I think when we speak of feminist education, we're really speaking perhaps of two different kinds of things. On one level, we're speaking about the education of women and the need for women to be educated as well about women in the world, which is, of course, the genesis of women's studies. But as we've evolved women's studies over the last 15 to 20, 25 years, and begun to look more deeply, I think we see feminist education as not only for women, but really an education that men should have as well in gender, in the issues of gender, and how it shapes both male and female lives. So, for example, at my university at Rutgers, we call the program Women's and Gender Studies because we think both of those aspects of feminist education are important. There is still a specific need for women to learn about their situation as women and to see what that has meant in the world. But increasingly, we're all concerned that men as well as women understand what feminism is trying to say. It is, after all, a message that it's a politics and a message that should also resonate for men who would be interested in changing some of the forms of domination, violence, and so forth that have been associated with masculinity. So I think you see even more emphasis today on gender studies or making feminist education accessible to men as well as women. I think on women's leadership, there's been some specific work to provide women with access to leadership opportunities, again, on the assumption that it's harder for women to see themselves as leaders and to get that. So that's perhaps another piece of feminist education that's very women-specific.
Do you see any significant developments in the future with regards to women in education?
Well, I think we see a lot of interesting things happening around women in education. For one thing, I do think that women have had a big impact at the university level on the curriculum, so that there is now more scholarship on women, and that has translated into more courses, more opportunities to learn about women. But I also think that there's a development of women understanding how they've been tracked in the educational system into certain fields, and those fields are still viewed as the soft fields. So we're working both, I think, to get women into science and math and engineering and agricultural studies so that women have access to those other fields, but also the opposite, I think, to also raise the importance of what have been the soft fields of health and nursing and home economics and aspects of life that have been seen as the women's education spheres, teaching, nursing in particular, and raise the value of those so that both men and women who do that will value it and the world will value it. So in that sense, I think we see kind of continually reevaluating what's going on in education, and there's, of course, been a backlash against feminist work in the education sphere, and certainly in the United States. I don't know as much about Canada, but we have some anti-feminist groups trying to get rid of the new curriculum that gives more emphasis to women and men taking on similar roles or not feeling they have to do just a certain thing. So this is still a battlefield in that way. You still have school boards in the United States banning books that advocate for a wider range of roles for both women and men. And you have areas of, say, sex education or areas of thinking about different aspects of life or books that talk about lesbian and gays or minority groups. You have school boards arguing over whether these are appropriate for schools. All of these are, in a way, outgrowths of the feminist education work.
The next interview we will hear is with Justin Harmon, the Director of Communications at Wesleyan University in Connecticut.
Wesleyan University has recently gained notoriety for being one of the only campuses in North America to offer gender-neutral residences.
Here, he speaks to the importance of this service for transgendered and transsexual students.
London.
We're interviewing you
today because Wesleyan University has been in the news lately. Recently in the New York Times, there was an article on March 7th entitled Biology 101 that spoke about Wesleyan's transgender support system. And we wanted to know, in Montreal, why Wesleyan? What is the draw for transgender students? What is Wesleyan doing right?
I'd like to think we're doing some things right and that we're doing similar right things for all of our students. Wesleyan has a residential life experiment for the last year that I think has attracted some attention. We have a couple students who self-identify as transgender and who approached us about how the residential life experience in the first year primarily could be adapted or to their experience. Specifically, the issue surfaced around the possibility of having a roommate. One thing that we are learning is that the experience of the first year and the communal sort of situation that you find in the standard residential hallway that is the first year experience for most students can be more challenging for a student who identifies as transgender, and particularly when it comes to the residential pairing that happens in a dormitory setting. So what we did was to create a hallway where students could draw in regardless of gender. That is to say, they could simply state their preference as they were applying for housing to draw into a space where gender is not a factor in assigning roommates. And we had 12 living spaces on this hallway. Some of them were in single rooms, some of them were in two-room doubles, and we had 8 first-year students draw in and 4 class students.
What's the feedback from students concerning the transgender, if it's been a positive experience, if you've experienced any negative feedback from students, parents, community, professors, et cetera?
On the campus community, I think the reaction has been very positive. The students who drew into the hallway have expressed satisfaction with their experience. I think that the challenge has been in terms of the interface between that hallway and the sort of the larger community. Since the experiment received a lot of press attention, mm-hmm. We had many, many inquiries from folks who wanted to visit the hallway with cameras and interview all the residents, et cetera, et cetera. And that, for us, raised privacy issues.
Yes.
I think the other lesson that we learned is that the primary accommodation that seems to be important to the transgender students that we've worked with here to this point is for privacy. Mm-hmm. In other words, they need the space. They want to live in a communal space like other first-year students, but they also need privacy space. And so the infrastructure of the residential hall is important.
Mm-hmm.
It's important that there be private bedroom space, that there be private bathroom space. And we think that by providing that sort of accommodation as well as an option to room with another student who also wants the option of drawing into a room without reference to gender,
mm-hmm.
that we'll actually do a better job of accommodating transgender students going forward. In general terms, we try to organize our housing in the first year in particular in such a way that students are mixed together and can take advantage of the diversity of Wesleyan classes. We have students from all 50 states and 50 foreign countries and just from all backgrounds and experiences, and we think in general all students benefit when they're mingled together in such a way that they can meet and share experiences and learn from each other's backgrounds. So I think that's what we've learned going forward, both the important aspects of the accommodation and how to do this in a way that integrates with the rest of the residential life experience for all of our students. I think that's what we've learned going forward, both the important aspects of the accommodation and how to do this in a way that integrates with the rest of the residential life experience for all of our students.
And do you think that other universities can only really do this type of thing that Wesleyan is doing if they have the correct infrastructure, if they have rooms that have privacy, if they have private bathrooms? What do you think are any hindrances that other universities are facing that might want to do a similar thing?
Well, I think that, that's a good question. Wesleyan is fortunate because we have a lot of single bedrooms on campus that are available to first-year students. We have a lot of bathrooms with what I call privacy infrastructure, that is to say, stall showers, stall toilets. Most universities have enough variation or enough variety in their housing stock that if they're thoughtful about the need to accommodate and how they distribute students among the house, the various housing options, that they can be sensitive also.
And have other universities come forward to Wesleyan asking them, saying that they've had similar requests from students or doing
sure.
it on their own, thinking that this is going to be something that they're going to need to progress into the future, even before, students have expressed interest?
We've actually had a lot of interest from other universities from the outset of the pilot, from the moment we indicated we were going to do this in the current year, because transgender students are, in some sense, emergent in the college-age population. So schools want to know how to proceed, how to accommodate these students and in a way that is respectful of their needs and also makes sense in terms of the overall undergraduate experience. So, yeah, we've had a lot of inquiries. I think what you see in the New York Times article is that other schools have been dealing with this issue and in some cases to do one-on-one accommodation, looking at individual circumstances and then finding a place within the overall residential infrastructure where that makes sense.
I mean, do you think that given the application process that larger universities adapt a similar process, that they can in turn pair people who would be willing to share housing with transgender students?
It strikes me that that's a possibility, and of course I can't speak for other institutions,
mm-hmm.
but most schools in this day and age have a way of enabling students who can self-identify as having a need for a particular kind of accommodation, be it in the classroom or in the residence hall setting. And I think what's really needed is to adapt that process in such a way that's respectful of this population.
Definitely. And have you had more feedback, positive feedback, more transgender students applying to Wesleyan in the past year? Because you've probably gone through an application process since you've started.
We have, actually, but it's interesting. Most students, in our experience, don't self-identify explicitly in the context of the application process. That's fairly unusual.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to be more often the case that students are wrestling more internally with these issues, and so it may be that for some of them, Wesleyan is now on their radar screens because it has a reputation by dint of this particular experiment as making an effort to accommodate, but they aren't necessarily telling us that.
Great. And I'm just curious, has there been any negative backlash, any from the community, professors, students, their parents, anything about this? Have you gotten any negative feedback?
Not from the community itself. We've had some from the public at large because the issue got so much play that I think it became sort of a lightning rod,
yeah.
Sort of a symbolic issue for folks who wanted to have another platform to make points about how God created men and women.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a flashpoint, but in terms of the life of the campus, it has not been, I think, at all a divisive issue. I think we've all learned a lot from the experience and feel positive about it.
Yeah, well, I know in general, Wesleyan is known for being a very progressive university, so it seems like if such a system were to start, that would be the place. So very
well, I think that, it is a place that values respect for others, and
mm-hmm.
that is a fundamental value and has been at Wesleyan for a very long time. So I think this is an extension of that philosophy, and it's something that we're proud of.
Personally, if you want to answer this, you don't have to, but where do you think the notion of gender begins?
That's, I think, potentially a very deep philosophical question.
Yes.
And it's got to do a lot with culture and how we're acculturated. And I think part of what's happening right now, just as somebody who's observing this from the vantage point of middle age, is that as a society, we're grappling with the question that you're asking, and that is reflected in our students' willingness, need to personify these questions or to explore them in terms of their own lives. I don't think we actually know yet, as a society, to what extent this sort of upsurge in terms of interest in transgender questions will actually yield a sense that, you know, a fundamentally different view of gender than what we've had heretofore.
Mm-hmm. And do you think some of the students, you said, you know, students come from all different backgrounds, all different countries, states, et cetera, at Wesleyan, do you think that your support systems have helped people, in a sense, unlearn and relearn gender just by virtue of being around different types of people? And, you know, I mean, I guess you can't speak from, obviously, a student standpoint, but have you observed anyone or articles in the student paper or, you know, town paper saying that people are starting to learn that gender is not necessarily a black and white issue or not, you know, completely polarized?
I think that that's an interesting question. My sense is that what we're actually seeing is that that's already happening as students are coming to us. In other words, the reason that this is an emergent issue in terms of the college-age population is that it's emergent actually in high school and elsewhere in the culture, and that students, young people, are experiencing a freedom of exploration in terms of themselves, and so that's simply reflected on college campuses, and it's something that because students are leaving home in most cases for the first time, they come to campus in part to play those experiences out and test them, and that's part of our function. That's part of what higher education is.
Yeah. And speaking of higher education and the whole people coming of age and learning about themselves and deciding which gender they identify with most, do you think there can be transgender support systems for earlier years in high school if people decide not to go to college? Or do you think it would be healthy for the society to start implementing more transgender support earlier on in life?
That's a very good question, and it's a deep question, and I think I'm probably out of my expertise.
Okay. Don't worry about it.
I think that kids need the freedom to come to terms with themselves. There's a conservative part of me who's a parent who also wants to say there's time to sort this out, and I worry that because, and this is a negative, I think, for me, aspect of our culture and society, we're forcing sex on our kids at such a point that they're not necessarily exploring it naturally. I think the question, it gets forced for them before it needs to be. And so I worry a little bit the question is, how do you encourage the exploration in a way that's congruent with their development and supportive of who they are,
mm-hmm.
without, in some sense, forcing questions before they're ready to hatch?
Yes.
I don't have the answer to it.
And have you noticed your parenting style changing whatsoever? I know you have a few kids. I don't know their ages or anything.
Yeah, I actually have a large family. I have 8 kids.
Oh, wow.
I want to say yes, because what I learn on the job certainly affects who I am. And it's one of the reasons I work in higher education. I just find this to be a fascinating period in life, and the ferment on and conversation on the college campus has always been important to me.
The more drums we have in our kit, the more jobs we can handle.
We're going to take a break here.